how precisely the upholstery is stitched, how logically the instruments are arranged.
Datsun workmanship is all the salesmanship I need.
Drive a Datsun for all it's worth. We are driven.
See your Datsun dealer and inspect all the new Datsuns.
There are 8 women astronauts out of 80 astronauts. I think we have a reasonable proportion of women in the office based upon the mixture of people and backgrounds that we have. Up until the selection that I was chosen, NASA was primarily interested in test pilots, but now that the shuttle program has branched into the mission specialist role availability, there was a much more wider advertisement, so to speak, of these are the types of people we're interested in for the shuttle, and you aren't restricted to being a pilot. And I think that opened up the opportunity for more people to be aware that there were selections going on and to go ahead and apply. I am a civil servant. I work for the government. I have no affiliation with the military. A number of the astronauts do. They came from the military, and they retain their rank, and in effect, they're on loan to NASA. But we all work for the same objectives, which is a space program, so it's really it comes down to which organization pays your check. Well, I think that there's a good chance that every astronaut in the office will be going up. As a matter of fact, that's the plan. That's why there's as many astronauts as there are. There's an awful lot of missions planned in the next several years, and we need a lot of astronauts to do a lot of missions. So I think that everybody has a chance to go and probably will. The objective is that the shuttles flights will become routine and frequent, and it won't be quite like in the past where most astronauts had one flight or maybe two or occasionally three. Hopefully it'll evolve to where, you know, this is a real career thing and we'll get the opportunity to fly many times.
The children of our generation are going to inherit what our society has left them. So, as parents, we have certain responsibilities. When their time has come, will our children write us a favorable history?
Well, I don't think the basic problems are any different than what they always have been. And essentially, for me, the basic problem is a lack of self-esteem. Basic problem is one of insecurity, and I think it comes from relationship with adults. I have a kind of notion about children, and that is that, while I don't subscribe to the theory of IQ, by that I mean measuring the IQ and saying this is what your IQ is, as though it's some sort of thing that can't change. But for the sake of the statement, I think children are born with an IQ of something like 200, and it comes down in direct proportion to their connection with adults. I think adults continually limit their children instead of doing the reverse, instead of opening up for them and supporting them in their searches. And it's part of that process that adults kind of continually to limit and negate and say stop and no and quit and you're no good and get out of my way. Continually doing that to their children, I think, is what leaves us with a legacy of children who are drug addicts and children who are alcoholics and children who are obsessive and compulsive in order to make up for this terrible sense of emptiness they feel. And I think that'll continue to be the problem until we come out as a group of parents who are willing to support our children in development. Once we can learn to tell children that we love them, that they are lovable, that they are capable of whatever they are capable of, and let them search out and find those things for themselves, then I think that solves the problems. The best thing a parent can do for his child is stay out of the way. That doesn't mean that a parent should not set limits. I'm very much in favor of parents setting limits. I think there are certain things that, because of their lack of experience and because of our experience, we know are not okay for kids, and that's fine. What I'm saying is, in these specific areas, and those are areas of exploration, opening up, having courage, we have to allow ourselves to have the courage to let them find their own way.
When space travel becomes routine due to vehicles like the space shuttle, many nations will participate in science experiments in space.
Space will grow because of international pressures. The Russians are doing it, the Japanese, the Chinese are doing it. They all are doing it for national interest purposes. In other words, the Japanese see this. Solar power, it's a great way to, their 95% of their oil and their energy comes from abroad. The French see it as a way of showing the rest of the world they're great too. The Ariane was a French idea to compete with NASA and with the Russians. So every country's in it for their own purpose. And one of those purposes is financial, it's economic. The environment of space has so many advantages that much of our industry in the future will be done in space. There's pharmaceuticals, there's metallurgy, there's minerals from space, there's solar power. In other words, the economy of the future, if we're not going to fall back into chaos, will only be saved by space. There's going to be a backlash. There's going to be people who are going to say, the money, why couldn't it be spent better on Earth? they don't realize that this is one of the things that's creating, if there's a supply side economics, which is a nice term nowadays, space provides that supply of resources and fuel. What we're going to see is development of other countries in space. Now, we won't see this in our lifetime. I mean, it'll take time. It was 1492 to 1776 before an independent country was established in the Western Hemisphere. But as space develops, as we develop the ability to have self-sufficient colonies in space, self-sufficient colonies can become independent over time. Their interests will differ, so that what we're going to see is a totally different international regime.
The food industry is a great industry in the United States. I don't care in what section of this country people will eat. The restaurant business has always been what is referred to as the mama and papa industry with one or two owners. That's changing. The major corporations are acquiring restaurants and going into that as a massive exchange program. And then on top of that, they talk about fast food operations. The heyday is not over. As long as the population continues to grow, there will be a need to eat. That is a great industry for the future. On top of that, real estate is always going to be here. It is changing and is becoming a very sophisticated industry. For those people who have a good math aptitude as well as a good people skills, that is a fantastic industry. The computer industry, well, the integrated circuit, which was the component that brought us into the 20th century, is now bringing it to the position where computers, and I'm talking about home computers, a calculator, mini computers, will be in every office in America. That is a super industry. The industries that seem to be no growth industries are the industries that seem to be related to things that are going out of the past. As an example, we're now into the small economical car. If you're looking to be involved in an industry that puts a lot of flash and chrome, it's going to go the way of the buggy. You've got to say to yourself, what will you be buying? What will you be doing 5 years from now? And there are a lot of things that are coming out. And the new look to the future depends upon what we're seeing today. And I'm very confident that the future is excellent for the employment market in general.
We work hard for our money. How can we make every dollar count?
At Datsun, we believe the greatest economy of all is quality.
Drive a Datsun for all its worth.
Protect your new car dollar by investing in the 1981 Datsun 210 SL hatchback.
These days you hear a lot of talk about miles per gallon. Well, one voice still talks about years per car.
Talk to me, Datsun.
Every 1981 Datsun is built with a one-piece solid steel unibody, not hung together by nuts and bolts.
Far less rattles.
And far more years.
Drive a Datsun.
Every Datsun is armed to resist rust, built with panels of galvanized steel, coatings of zincometal, yards of sealers, and special anti-chipping compound.
A sky roof is available, and you get reclining bucket seats, split fold-down rear seats, a 5-speed stick, and a solid steel unibody, all riding on radial tires.
But will it drive us to the poorhouse?
The new Datsun 210 is a lot of car, not a lot of money.
Nice work, Datsun.
Hey, if we didn't drive ourselves the way we do, your Datsun wouldn't drive the way it does.
Drive a Datsun for all it's worth. We are driven.
To give you more miles per gallon and more years per car. A wise investment.
Credit is basically man's trust in man. It helped to develop this country. It helped to develop the free world. But talking on a consumer level, I predict that, for instance, you'll buy a car, and in the car we'll have a little computer, and about the 20th of the month, a little thing will come on your computer screen in the car, and basically it'll say, oh, don't forget, on next Tuesday your payment's due. You'll send your payment in to General Motors or some other major company, and they'll send you next month's disc, and you'll put that disc in the computer, like a little coin maybe, or a little card or a little plastic or something, and that'll give you the use of your car for another month. And if you don't pay, and boom, that car just freezes up and nothing moves it. I think where we're going, maybe when you reach 18, you'll have the right to apply for what I see in the future is a universal credit card. And everything will be billed to you on a central location. And if you go in one day and you're delinquent and you haven't programmed yourself to pay these accounts, when you go to the merchant and he puts your card in there and they push the buttons to okay the charge and you have been a bad guy, I think the little card's going to be punched holes in it, and that's the end of your charge privileges. And maybe you have to go down to some central headquarters at some future time reapply or reestablish yourself. But I see the granting and the administration of credit on all levels to be totally computerized, and I think we will have a universal credit card, or maybe three or four universal credit cards. I'm sure we'll have some form of competition. So I think we should be looking forward to almost a total credit society.
In the private sector, large corporations are acquiring channels on existing satellites for new applications, including internal television hookups.
Large business organizations in the United States and in other countries, too, are very conscious these days of constraints on their communications services. They are looking forward to more capacity, more capability in communications to give them greater productivity and efficiency. It's an increasingly paperwork society, as you know. The information is terribly important to all kinds of organizations these days. The timeliness, the accuracy, the accessibility of that information is of critical importance to large organizations. A communications system such as we offer them improves the information flow, the accessibility, the timeliness of it. Decision making is improved, general overall management of these large organizations is improved with better communications, better information service, and productivity. Anything that seems to have a beneficial effect on that productivity is of great interest and importance to large organizations. The video teleconferencing capability is going to be a very important one for communication systems of the future. These large businesses and government agencies too, dispersed around the United States, typically today, have regional meetings. Everyone gets on an airplane and flies off. If it's coast to coast, it can wipe 2 or 3 days of executive time out for a two-hour meeting. Our system offers at maybe 10, 20 locations a conference room equipped with audio and video equipment interconnected through the satellite system where these people get together, discuss their issues, problems, make decisions through the medium of teleconferencing.
I don't see any lack of interest in investigative reporting by young newsmen. I think most young newsmen would prefer to be investigative reporters, would prefer to dig up what the government covers up. It's the editors who don't want to take the risk. It's the publishers who don't want to offend their friends. Publishers associate with politicians. They belong to the same social circles, attend the same soirees. Publishers and some editors are lifted up on the mountaintop. They breathe the heady air up there in that rarefied atmosphere. They tend to view the world from the same perspective as the people who govern us. The result is that they don't like to see their friends exposed. Well, investigative reporting has been fashionable, but we are rolling toward the precipice. It's not popular. It's not popular with newspapers because it's risky. It's high-risk journalism. It's not popular with the public because they don't like to have their faith shaken. It's certainly not popular with the government because they don't like to have their secrets exposed. And yet it's essential to democracy. It's essential to the survival of liberty in this country.
She's interviewed King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, Golda Meir, and Fidel Castro, among others.
When we're talking about synthetic fuels, we are primarily talking about taking coal resources and turning them into conventional oil and conventional natural gas, because they are hydrocarbons just as oil and gas are. But most of our coal resources have a high sulfur content. In the eastern part of the United States, this is a problem as far as technology is concerned. Our low sulfur coal lies in the western states, but it's shallow and has to be strip mined, and you get into environmental problems there, which can be licked and reclaiming the land. But all of this technology, and also the technology of actually refining the coal into two other sources of energy, has been very expensive, which is why it has not been done before. We have known that we could get oil and gas from coal since World War II times, but in competitive terms with conventional oil and gas, the use of coal for synthetic fuels was not necessary until recently, when we had to start thinking in terms of the future and to see how the best technology could be developed in order to use it. And that's what's going on right now. Pilot plants are being built. They're licking the bugs of the various types of refining equipment. The best way to do these things, the most economic way to develop synthetic fuels, and that's why by the end of this century, by 2000, we probably will be producing the oil equivalent of 2 to 3 million barrels of oil from coal.
when there are fluctuations in a person's emotions, when there are rapid changes in a person's state of mind, as from being very peaceful to being angry, this, in a sense, sends out an emotional wave, per se. And this emotional wave is influencing the plants that I have been monitoring. And that influence shows up as changes in electrical activity inside the plant. What we end up with is a chart which has primarily two recordings on it, one which is the changes in a person's emotions, and the other which is a change in the plant's electrical field or activity. Those two are then statistically compared, and that's where we get our evidence. But what its future influence will be, I hope, is not so much to demonstrate the plants are sensitive, but to point out that there is a parallel reality, that we as human beings radiate this state of mind, this consciousness, and that it's real, that in fact it does exist. That we're not just talking about something that has to do with table tipping and odd people with crystal balls and ghosts and haunted houses. I'm talking about a very real dimension. And my purpose in doing the research was to demonstrate that that very real dimension has some reality here in this world, that we can demonstrate it. It's demonstrable.
I foresee that much like insurance, which is now an accepted household word, that people will consider it a form of insurance and more contracts will be drawn up. I am sure when insurance first was conceived that many people looked upon it with horror, because after all, what is insurance? It's a hedge against death, disability, illness, fire, and other adverse future contingencies. But eventually, people began to recognize it. And I do think that as people continue to become aware, you will see more and more contracts being drawn up, and the stigma and the fear attached to it will lessen down the road. I maintain that rather than destroy, if two people really care for one another, it will actually fortify their love nest. Because people may have questions in the back of their minds that they were afraid to ask. Or they get into discussions. Once they talk about property between them, they raise points that actually become communication points that get them deeper into their relationship. Because there's a lot of things to think about. Not just if you break up. There's death, there's debts, there's children, there's common ownership of property, and there's even tax savings. And it might very well be that as they get into the preparation of an agreement, they will also get into these dollar savings discussions.
Well, my personal research has been in an area called the theory of heuristic search. Whenever you play a game such as chess, you not only use a great deal of knowledge, but you also, when looking at the board, must make deductions. So this requires a search procedure, because in chess, as in mathematics, there's such a myriad of decisions that there's no way to exhaustively analyze all of them. Instead, one has a sense of trying to make progress using what we call these heuristics or rules of thumb, even though the number of possibilities to even look a few moves ahead are in the billions or trillions. Practical consequences have been, in the last few years, we now have programs which are capable of diagnosing 4,000 to 5,000 diseases of man. This program, its name is Internist, was developed at the University of Pittsburgh, has a huge and extensive knowledge base where many of the symptoms of disease are put into this knowledge base, but it also has the area I study, a deductive component, the ability to reason about a specific set of symptoms that a particular patient may have, just as the specialist in internal medicine can reason. Internist is probably a better diagnostician than any single living doctor. It is simulating what we would normally call human thinking, and it's certainly doing it effectively because we can test it in comparison to specialists in the field.
Museums dedicated to holography are popping up, displaying three-dimensional images that seem to hang in space.
It really narrows down to two areas, either recording real life permanently or recording something that never existed before artistically. a large hologram of Venus de Milo is great. It's technically perfect. It looks like it's standing right there. Who cares? If you can go see the original. If you can't go see the original, then it's great. Somebody in Kansas City, oh, look at the Venus de Milo. It looks like it's right there. I can't touch it anyway because it's behind a rope in the Louvre in Paris anyhow. And they see it sitting there. Great. That's recording real life. It has its place. It's not very creative. The creative part of holography really hasn't been exploited yet, but is coming along. More and more artists and sculptor people are getting involved in the creation of holograms. The technology is now so easy. First motion picture hologram was made out at Hughes Research Labs in Malibu. It was made on 35 millimeter film using a pulse ruby laser. They pulsed this off and they got footage of fish in a tank. That was done in 66. Mostly it's the Russians that are doing the most work in this area right now. They have a 3x4 foot screen, I believe, using pulse laser system, and it really is there. It is monochromatic, though. It is not full color. The image is red or blue-green. It depends on the color of the laser used to play it back. To get the quality, too, they use a laser for playback, which is an expensive piece of hardware at that size to illuminate that big a window. The film does move, and it does work. What they're going to do with it, I have no idea.
The recent introduction of the video disc presents a challenge to the entertainment industry, not just in consolidating a universal format for the consumer, but a marketing strategy must be developed as well. From a commercial standpoint, the video disc straddles the void between two vastly different programming fields, television and radio.
I think it's an evolving thing. I think it's in its infancy. I think, like color TV, it's going to take a while for the price to come down. We're a ways from the mass appeal market for video. I think it's an elitist market at this point. Let's give it 5 years. Nevertheless, it's a very promising perspective as far as the record companies are concerned, because video offers immediate artist identification. This is where the clubs come in. Clubs around the country have video systems, and I can have my group appearing in every club in the country that has a video machine tomorrow. Now, there seems to be some problems with exploiting this right at the current moment because of some union problems, but I think that's very promising for artist development. And the video disc itself, I'm one of those believers that television didn't kill radio, and radio is stronger than ever, and I feel that water will seek its own level with this video thing, and while, again, we're in the infancy, I think that the record business will remain pretty much intact through all of this, because I think the thing about music is that it's a background medium, and that one can only see that visual image so much, that one listens to music and is doing other things while they're listening to music, especially from my perception if they're dancing. So video is part of the ball game. It's an evolving thing. I don't know that it's coming in at the right time due to the nation's economy, but that it's going to be a plus for the record business more than a negative.
The post-war baby boom is older now, and their music tastes have changed. If popular music is a reflector of society at that moment, what will the next generation of buyers be shopping for?
I have a feeling that we are never going to experience another pop messiah in the same way that we had with Elvis Presley or the Beatles. It's a different world now, and we're different. Everybody has a time, a certain bracket of years, usually the years that they were in high school or college, that they were the most tuned into music. That was because they didn't have other things to worry about and had the mental space and so forth to really pay attention to it. And there was a time when a whole lot of us were approximately the same young age and had the time to really get swept up in a Beatlemania craze or an Elvis phenomenon. We're not that unified anymore. We're all individuals now, and we're all charting our own courses. One of the peculiarities of the American pop music scene is the baby boom generation grew up listening to a rather narrow range of sounds on AM radio in the 50s and 60s. As they've gotten older, their tastes have diversified, and they are getting into many different kinds of music. It's going to be whatever you want it to be, because it's going to be not one music scene, it's going to be many different music scenes, and you're going to fit into whichever one is most comfortable for you. It's going to be very diverse, and now that you've come into your own, you'll be able to pick and choose the kinds of music that means something to you, that strikes the right emotional chords within yourself, and it's going to be quite a decade.
There is absolutely no evidence at all that there is life anywhere off the Earth. But the thinking of a great many scientists is that it's almost impossible for there not to be, and that if there's life, that there's most likely intelligent life. Just so happens that in our solar system, there's only one planet the right distance away from the sun with the right chemicals available for life to form, and that's the Earth. But in experiments done in the laboratory on Earth, if you take some of the chemicals that we think were around at the time that we think life started here on Earth and put them in a bottle and send a spark across simulating a lightning bolt, you get amino acids, the building blocks of life. They just drop out into the soup, and if you had the right conditions long enough, you could probably start to get DNA forming life, forming self-replicating machines almost. Life is like a machine, really. So it's almost unthinkable that it hasn't happened elsewhere. We just don't know where, and the other planets are so far away that we don't really have any way of finding out. Now, we were hoping that there might be some form of life on Mars, and we haven't ruled it out. Viking didn't find any life. But on Earth, if you look in the most unlikely places, in the ices of Antarctica, boiling sulfur ponds, you find life. So the Earth chauvinism, as Carl Sagan calls it, leads you to think that if there's life on a planet, it's going to be covering the planet, and it isn't covering Mars.
What we are looking at is the next step in the evolution of the human race. You can compare the step from Earth into space to the fish coming out of the ocean onto the land, or the monkeys leaving the trees and going to the savanna and developing into humans. The same social conditions existed then as they do now, although a lot of people don't relate to that. Moving into space is going to produce as much change in the human race as those other two examples. In the future, as an anthropologist and as a futurist, I see a situation, especially on Earth, where our national boundaries will disappear. We are going to consider ourselves one culture, not so much meaning that we're all the same, but we're going to be thinking in global terms. We are Earth people. We are not Americans versus Canadians versus Japanese versus Germans fighting in Angola, fighting in El Salvador, fighting here, fighting there. We are going to be a united group working together to develop space resources for all our benefits. So therefore, our global outlook is going to really be there, whereas we don't have that now. We have a national outlook. And before, we used to have a territorial outlook. Pretty soon, we'll have a global outlook. We are all Terrans, we're Earth people. We don't need these petty squabbles, we can get along without that. We don't need to annihilate ourselves. If we take enough care to plan, we can be here in the next century. Developing space is going to be one major solution to our problems. We don't need to say, our problems are here, there's nothing we can do, we just have to fall under and go under with it. We need to take a positive outlook that we can solve these problems if we set our mind to it.
So far, no such luck.
Our move into space is as significant as the move of the amphibians onto land, and I think it will have just as great implications for our development. I think that great changes will happen almost immediately as soon as we get into space. I think the combination of the experience of these new media, holography, for example, when it becomes the medium that it can be, when it is possible to project holographic three-dimensional objects in space rather than in a frame or on a window or whatever. If you can project those images in space, it will be impossible to tell them apart from a real object. And at that point, of course, the difference between reality and art or entertainment begins to blur. And with that, and freeing ourselves from the gravity well, freeing ourselves from the Earth's electromagnetic field, not to mention all the electromagnetic pollution to which we're constantly exposed in the form of radio and TV broadcasts. I don't mean the kind you tune in on your TV set. I mean the kind that your brain is constantly trying to tune in because you're receiving all that input. When you get away from all of that in space, I think it's going to change the way we think about things. And we believe now that the way we think about things has a great deal to do with the way things are. We've already found that when people go into space and look back at the Earth and see the whole Earth hanging in the sky, they have a different perspective of their place on it and in human society.
The key to the future is loving yourself, discovering yourself, relying on yourself, indulging yourself, improving yourself, and not depending on society or religion or any of the familiar traditional approaches, because they simply are outmoded and can do nothing but hold you back in your own personal evolution. And any person in reasonable health today who commits themselves to a future of development can really evolve and change more in the next 20 or 30 years than our species has since the Paleolith, Neolith days. And it's simply dumb not to become smarter, to hang out with intelligent people, to use the new technologies, and to take this incredible trip of self-transformation. But it's your own individuality. You've got to do it yourself, because we're talking now about frontiers where no one has gone before. It's the old Captain Kirk Star Trek. We're not kidding around. We're zooming into the future with such acceleration that you have to have a tremendous amount of confidence in yourself and in your friends and in your sources of information. If you have that, we literally are going to write our own futures. And it's the most exciting, adventurous, changeable time in history. And go for it and surf it. The trick is to be at the right place at the right time. I would avoid the Middle East, for example. I would avoid Africa, because they're not going to be fun places in the next 10 or 15 years. These are primitive zones. The place to be is in North America, and I think particularly in the West Coast, in neighborhoods where like-minded people, open-minded people, fast-moving individuals who want to get smarter, hang out and swarm. And we are a species, those of us that want to grow and become smarter. We can tell each other, we can recognize each other. We are different. I'm not saying we're better, but there are millions of us popping up, particularly in the West Coast of Canada and the United States. And the trick is geography. Where you are determines which levels of your brain you're activating. So hang out in zones and sectors where you're surrounded by happy people that like themselves and want to grow and will stimulate you and kid you and laugh with you and get you moving, because we do need that swarming momentum of a lot of us moving the same way together. That was a great thrill of the 60s, and it's going to be the great thrill of the 80s, that sensing that you're an intelligent, conscious part of an enormous group of human beings that are heading up and out for bigger and better things.
And that's today's look at the world of tomorrow. Our guest has been author and futurist Dr. Timothy Leary. This is Future File, sponsored by Datsun, who remind you that in every Datsun, the greatest economy of all is quality.
Very carefully.